Welcome to another episode of the Gabe Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Gregor Mattson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Oberlin College Conservatory, who is also an author working on a book about changes in gay bars in the U.S. Welcome to the show, Gregor.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. So I understand you have a background in sociology and gender studies and things of that nature, and that your current project is a book about gay nightlife. So pretty much this entire Gabe Archives project I've been working on is, you know, right in your wheelhouse. It's everything that you studied and worked on pretty much your whole career.
Not my whole career. This is my second project.
Oh, okay. What was the first?
My first major project was on prostitution legal changes in the European Union.
Oh, yes. I remember seeing that.
Yeah. So this is my second project, which is sort of a return to some work I did early in grad school.
Very cool. Now, when we were talking about some of the bars that were important to your life and so on, I asked you what the first bar experience, gay bar experience was that you had. And you came up with an answer that turns out to be one of the most iconic bars, not only in the Pacific Northwest, but in the entire country. It's got quite a story behind it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So the first bar that I went to, if it counts as a bar, was the City Nightclub in Portland, Oregon. I grew up in a small town in Washington State that's now in the Portland suburbs, but at the time was its own separate little, you know, off in the boondocks kind of. But it was an all ages gay dance club that didn't serve alcohol. And it was owned by this guy, Lanny Swerdlow, who I only learned about much more recently from reading newspaper articles about him. But it was the only place you could go as a high school student where you would be surrounded by other queer folks. And it was in the industrial district of Portland, Oregon. You could smell the Henry Weinhardt's brewery when you would find parking in this industrial zone, sort of up against the freeway. Lighting was not very good. It has since totally gentrified. Now it's the swankiest part of Portland, Oregon. That what used to be the nightclub is an architect studio and a videography studio. The brewery is now condos, bike lanes, streetcars, baby strollers. You know, it's totally unrecognizable. But until it closed, the City Nightclub was the only all-ages gay dance club in the country.
Now, what time frame was it when you went there?
I went there, and I recently had to figure this out. I'm pretty sure I went there for the first time in 1993, because the first song I heard when I walked in was Hadaway's What is Love? And at the time, I thought that was amazing. And of course, now it's a song we've all heard way too many times. And then Saturday Night Live ruined it for everyone. But at the time, that was the first song I heard in the club. And that came out in 1993.
So if you do a little research online and look on YouTube, there's actually a very kind of fuzzy, hazy version clip of an ad that was done for that nightclub back in about the time you were going there, I think. And I wanted to point out a couple of things. I'm sure you've seen it, but you know, they talk about this club, everything is in superlatives. The hottest music in videos, the most fabulous dancers with a little extension, most fabulous dancers, outrageous stage shows. And at the end of the commercial, they mentioned their, I guess, one of their slogans, violating traditional family values since 1983. So it was a pretty outrageous kind of place for, especially when you consider the fact that it was in Portland. It wasn't, you know, in LA or New York or some city that's known as being extremely progressive and having wild nightlife venues. And I also found there's an older kind of documentary by a guy named Gregory Franklin for the same bar. And one thing in particular that I remember about his movie, and I'll be interviewing him in the near future, but one thing I remember about his movie is that they claim that at the door, there was a sign that said, "Blatant heterosexual behavior will not be tolerated." So apparently they were embracing all of the LGBTQ spectrum as we know it now. I guess anything that was off the main path. Was it a pretty pretty exciting, invigorating experience for you while you were there?
So the first time I went, I was scared shitless. I was there with my girlfriend, the only girlfriend I ever had. And it was overwhelming, and it was also simultaneously, I was really relieved that everyone in there looked like suburban kids, but I was also really disappointed because at the time, the only gay teenagers that I had seen were on TV, and it was Michael Alig and those other club, New York Club Kids was about that time. Uh-huh. So, you know, you'd see them on Geraldo or Sally Jesse Raphael or whatever. And I had expected Club Kids, and there weren't any there. And it's only in subsequent, you know, reading about the city that I learned that it had this really vibrant underage drag scene, and it had this very vibrant underage club kid scene. And I never saw it, and I never saw a drag show there. And the only way that I can square this is I am sure that I was there on Friday nights, because both my girlfriend and I were avid churchgoers and went to church on Sunday mornings. So I'm sure we did not stay out really late on a Saturday night. I'm sure we were there on Friday nights. And my guess is that the Saturday was when the shows and the craziness would happen. Friday was suburban kids, and it was both underwhelming and overwhelming at the same time.
Did it have an impact on you at all as far as realizing some options of alternative sexuality? Then, you know, at that time you were in a heterosexual relationship. Did it kind of open your mind a little bit, or was that just a cover because you kind of felt like you needed to fit into the society?
The girlfriend was a cover. She was a good friend who was just very, she knew what she wanted, and I couldn't say no, but, I knew I was gay. I figured that I wouldn't have to tell anyone until I was 30. It was what the deal I had made with myself for whatever reason.
How'd that work out?
So, what's that?
How did that work out?
Oh, I think I waited till I was 20. So, but later, once I was out and going there, on summer breaks when I was coming home from college, being able to go there when I was 20, you know, I didn't realize that every city didn't have one. I went to college in Washington, D.C. I didn't go to bars until I turned 21 because I was such a good boy. And I didn't know that every city didn't have something like this. And it was only much later that I realized how unique the City Nightclub was. And, you know, I have always thought that everyone else was ahead of me in coming out or whatever. So I just take things in and don't form firm opinions about them, because I assume that everyone else already knows about it and everyone else has already decided whether it's good or bad. And that's a bad habit I've carried with me into life. So at the time, I assumed everyone had already been to a place like this, and I was just trying to catch up.
But while you were in DC, you did discover after you turned 21 that there was a vibrant gay nightlife there.
Yeah, absolutely. And friends of mine and I would go to the Trax nightclub in Southeast DC. It's gone now. I think the site is under the Department of Homeland Security now.
Yeah, there are several bars, oddly, in different cities, including, I think, one in Milwaukee, that the gay bar somehow ended up being a Homeland Security or, you know, Department of Defense building or something else. It's kind of ironic, but I guess somebody has to do something with them.
Well, it was part of Southeast DC at a time when the city was just starting to gentrify, and it had metro service, subway service. So you could take the subway from anywhere in the suburbs or whatever into this industrial zone. So in some ways it didn't make sense for it to be, you know, auto yards and muffler shops, but there were also Black churches and Black neighborhoods there. And all of that got displaced because when the government expanded post 9/11, all of that became sort of a government district. I haven't gone back there. But it used to be, when you would go get on the last train of the night, which would be around 11 o'clock PM, the last trains, you could see all the people going to Trax. You could pick them out. You know, people were young, they were dressed up, they had their face makeup on. People were really giddy. You transfer trains at Metro Center, and you could see who was coming from your train and going to transfer to the Green Line to go down to Navy Yard to go to Trax. And when you'd come out, we were always warned to watch out for being mugged or whatever. I don't know whether the neighborhood was actually unsafe or whether that was racist dog whistles just because it was a Black neighborhood. But there was just streams of people coming out of the subway. You know, you were walking in this giant herd that sort of trailed along the sidewalk and just sort of assembled at the line. The club had a metal detector, and you would get patted down. So it took a while for the doorman, door person to sort of process all of us who had been, you know, trailing in there together. Then you were on your own to get home. We would always share cabs, and it would be like four of us sharing a cab back to Northwest DC.
Trax has quite a history of its own. Yes. If I'm not mistaken, the original Trax was in Denver. And at some point in time, I guess in the late 70s, early 80s, they started to expand a little bit. I currently live in Tampa. And we had a Trax here as well that was part of the same family. And I've been to the one in D.C. Back when I was in college. I went down there numerous times. And they were quite the club, though. It was not just your average neighborhood bar with six bar stools. It was a club. It was a big deal for a young gay person to walk in there and go, wow, we have this fabulous facility. Now, for you, it was different. The ice had already been broken by the city nightclub, so you knew the concept. But for so many people that were just going out to a nightclub for the first time in their lives and had only seen little gay hole-in-the-wall bars along the street, it was quite an experience. I mean, the light shows, the music, the number of people, the energy, it was pretty fabulous.
Yeah, it was huge. The main room was vast, like could fit 1,000 people easily. But it also had the smaller dance room off to the side that would play alternative music. But it was where you could hear U2 and Depeche Mode and, who else? More sort of new wave, maybe some 80s throwbacks would be in that room. It was more house, dance, club remixes in the main room. But it also had this outside wooden deck that came out of the smaller dance floor, and outside the deck area was a sand volleyball court. So you would sometimes see people playing volleyball I remember dancing out in that on that deck in the snow, or when it started snowing, you know, very stupid of us to be in our t-shirts out in the cold until, and we were like sliding all around and thought it was great. And then, you know, the security came and chased us inside because it was probably best that we not be sliding in the ice. But they also had a lot of live shows. So I definitely saw Jimmy Somerville there. I can't remember who all else I saw, but they would have, you know, big name recognition shows of people who would come out, perform on their stage.
Yeah, they did the same thing in their Tampa location. And the only one, I think there's still a Tracks in Denver.
Oh, interesting.
The original owner passed away several years ago, but they still have a Tracks in Denver. And to my knowledge, it's the only one left out of that family of Tracks. I'm sure other cities have borrowed the name over the years, as they tend to do, but there is still one left. Now, I asked you about a couple of other bars that you had mentioned that were important to you, and one in particular is an anomaly in the world of gay bars. So many gay bars are open for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, and then just completely vanish. Either they go out of business because people's tastes change, or gentrification, or whatever the reason is, they disappear. But one bar that had a major impact on you has been in business for ever. I think it's like 93 years or something now. It's been there for quite a long time. And that one was in Oakland, California, the White Horse. What was the White Horse like the first time you walked in there?
So the White Horse Inn is in Oakland, but it's just across the border from Berkeley City. And it was, for a long time, the closest bar that served alcohol to the University of California, Berkeley, because Berkeley originally didn't allow liquor licenses or beer licenses after the end of liquor licenses weren't allowed in Berkeley after the end of Prohibition. And so what had been, I'm told, a kind of Italian restaurant remade itself into a nightclub in, I believe, 1933 or 1934, right upon the end of Prohibition. And so it always benefited from being the closest sinful place to UC Berkeley with its tens of thousands of undergraduates. I lived around the corner from it when I was going to grad school at UC Berkeley. So the White Horse Inn was the first time that I had a gay local. Like, it was a place where I definitely stopped there on the way home from work. It was the time I went out, you know, some weeks, almost every week there. It's definitely the bar that I've been to the most. And it's the time in my life that, when I really had a local, where a place where I went, I knew the names of a couple of the bartenders. They knew what I drank. I knew what songs were going to be played on a Friday versus a Saturday. I don't remember which one I had a preference for, but I had a preference and went, you know, more on one night than the other because I liked the music the DJ played better. The bar's still going, as far as I know. Last I checked, of course, Berkeley, now there's liquor licenses everywhere, but there hasn't been a closer gay bar to the Berkeley campus. So it still sort of benefits from being near so many grad students and undergrads. But yeah, I used to live maybe two and a half blocks away.
Now, I've noticed I've dug up a couple of their old ads, some older than others. And there seemed to be a common thread in a couple of them that the nickname for the bar that they embraced themselves was the Ho. They have ads that say, come party at the Ho. And then it's got the White Horse logo, or Halloween at the Ho was their Halloween ad series. Was there a reason for that? Was it particularly known for, you know, for being conducive to, you know, pickups and tricks and sexual activity? Or is it just somebody thought it was a funny abbreviation for horse and went with it?
I heard it called the White Ho. But jokingly, I actually saw it written in any of these ads that you're referencing. I never heard people call it the Ho. And I don't remember it as being particularly cruisy in a certain sense. Now, maybe this was because I was treating it as my local and therefore wasn't, like, I'm trying to remember. I don't know that I ever picked up from there. Even though I lived around the corner and it would have been really easy to have taken someone home, I don't know that I ever did, to be honest. I'll have to, you know, ransack my memory banks. But I think it's just, especially gay men think that they're clever when they adopt the language of sex workers. And I don't know whether it's probably a combination of allyship and misogyny at the same time, is my guess.
I assume that the reason, especially in the later ads, the ads from like the late 90s, 2000, whatever, into the 2000s, they probably would have dropped the white just because of the racial implications. It sounds even worse. I mean,
yes,
a hoe is one thing, but a white hoe is, you know. So that may have had something to do with the reason, because of course it's much easier to find more current ads than it is to find some from 40 or 50 years ago.
Yeah. No, I was going there, especially between 1999 and 2003. But, you know, it is that South Berkeley, North Oakland area was a Black neighborhood. It was rapidly gentrifying at that time. At the time when I moved to the Bay Area, vacancy rates in apartments was less than 1%. And it's kind of like now where you'd show up to an open house and someone would pay, you know, first and last month's rent in cash without even looking at the apartment. Just, and it would end the showing just because people were desperate for a place to live. I lived in a really crappy, illegal, converted garage that had no insulation and no padding under the carpet on the floor. But, you know, it let me live near the White Horse, which was at the time my priority. It was bicycling distance from campus, and, you know, the bar was in between campus and me. So the people who I would go with were colleagues and grad students, and I don't know that any of them were picking up there either, to be honest. I mean, I'm sure people were, and it's not like I was a virgin or being saintly, but it just wasn't picking up there.
Well, so far we've talked about three bars that played some kind of role in your coming out experience and your early days of exploring gay nightlife. And all three of those bars, in their own way, are rather iconic. So it seems almost like you're a good luck charm for these bars. You walk in there, you have a few drinks, you start going, you know, making that a home. And the next thing you know, they're in the history books. So that's a pretty good thing, you know, you got going for you there.
Now,
another bar that you mentioned to me that I had never heard of before, but of course my project focuses, for a number of reasons, mostly on bars in the U.S. But you had mentioned one in Helsinki by the name of DTM. First of all, how did you end up in Helsinki?
I am Finnish American. My dad is, I'm half, I should say. But there's so few Finns that even if you're half, they count you. And my dad has, you know, extended family in Finland. And what we went there when I was a child. I went there again, I want to say in 1999. Always had an interest in Finland because there's not, like I say, there's not that many Finnish Americans. There's not many Finns in the world. And I was living in Britain for 2 years at the end of the 90s and went over and saw the cousins and went to a conference there. And it was while I was there for a conference, I went to DTM and saw, you know, who I thought was the most handsome person in the whole world. And we hooked up. He is a doctor and was then a doctor. And he had to work nights in the hospital. And so we hooked up in the room that was there for doctors to sleep in while they were sort of on shift or whatever. I'm sure that's not kosher. He had to let me in through a back door, sort of hustle me into this room. And so it was, of course, very romantic. And but then I spent more time in Finland, one time for 2 months, you know, the following year, and then another time for 5 months, because some of my first research project was based in Finland. Then I went to DTM all the time, you know, like every weekend. And DTM stands for Don't Tell Mama. I don't know why it has that name. Nobody calls it that. Everyone calls it DTM. It was at the time, for a long time, it was about the largest dance club in the city. Helsinki isn't that big of a city, but it's the biggest city in Finland. And it's, you know, I don't know what percentage of the Finns live in Greater Helsinki, but it's a significant proportion. The club, as I understand it, it's run as a nonprofit. The board that governs it is dominated by the National LGBTQ plus rights organization, CETA. And so DTM actually received, in Finland, the gambling is regulated by the government, and the slot machines, there's slot machines in grocery stores, but the slot machines, all the profits from the slot machines go to this fund that funds like worthy causes. So like domestic violence shelters and refugee resettlement programs are funded by slot machines. And this particular, what was probably the largest gay club in the country. And it had, you know, one large dance floor. It was definitely cruisy, especially if you were an American who was visiting for the weekend or for the summer, because, you know, in a relatively smallish town, when you are fresh meat, you are briefly very, very popular. It always wears off, but it is very nice during those few weeks when everyone wants to know your name and people buy you drinks and, you know, well, when you're young and pretty, you get those things anyways. But
now I noticed the pictures that I found of DTM online, that they were very blatantly gay affirming in the bar. You know, some gay bars just look like, if you didn't know it was a gay bar, if you walked in there when they were closed, you might have no clue.
Oh, but right.
This place has neon hearts and rainbow colors. It has, over one of the bars, I saw a big neon that said, "Celebrate yourself" in English, which I assume a lot of people in Finland probably speak English just to be able to conduct commerce with the rest of the European world. But yeah, there is,
especially LGBTQ plus people speak English because it's cosmopolitan. And if you're from sort of a peripheral country that speaks the even more peripheral language, people are getting access to LGBTQ plus resources in English on the internet.
Did you pick up any Finnish at all, or?
I studied Finnish because I'm a freak. So I do speak some Finnish, not enough to pick someone up, but enough to impress them.
I know.
And enough to know when I'm being called a slur on the street. and enough to know how to respond if someone calls you a slur. What is the insult you should deliver back if you're willing to get in a fight over it?
Now, I do not speak Finnish. I have never attempted to speak Finnish, but I did notice that one of the pictures I've seen, I think from a Yelp review or something of TTM, had a Finnish word on it that I am probably going to massacre trying to pronounce. But it looks like it said something to the nature of Pumabaari, P-U-U-M-A-B-A-A-R-I.
Yeah, red. That means it's a red bar.
Okay, I don't know why it made, I don't know why, but.
Pumabaari means red bar. I mean, I would have heard people call it Homobaari.
Oh, yeah. Well, this particular, and actually this sign is in red neon, so that might have, I don't know. Maybe they had a particular bar in the, a particular bar counter that was that color and they served something different there. I don't know.
Well,
it was just curious to me.
I'll have to go look. You know, show me this later and I'll go look. Red has a ton of connotations there because of their civil war, because of their adjacency to the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union. So, yeah, I don't know what was going on. Red also, they have the whole like hearts and love and, you know, that kind of thing for red. But
the bar looked very cool. It looks very clean. It looked like a very modern, well-kept bar. Lots of disco-type lighting and mirror balls and all the trappings of a modern discotheque.
Well, the thing about it too, because it's getting this, it's not government support, but it's basically foundation support. They closed and renovated all the time. Like I have never, it also moved, you know, they would lose their leases and they've moved across town a couple times. They ended up on this, you know, they shut again in pandemic. Their website says that they'll be back and I don't doubt that they will. I don't doubt that they won't be back because of the support they have. But they ended up, it used to be that DTM was sort of off on its own. It wasn't near any of the other gay bars, and it also wasn't near any other clubs. It's not like it was in an industrial zone, but it just wasn't near other things. Where it was most recently was on sort of the bar and nightlife street. So it had basically moved to near a whole bunch of other straight clubs and bars so that going to DTM, you were passing lots of other revelers and nightlife folks, and it was on a nightlife street. So when it had moved there, I thought it was interesting because A, it meant they could afford the rent on what was a very desirable corner to be, but it also meant they weren't off by themselves. They were with the other nightlife places. So, you know, Finland is, you know, a relatively LGBTQ plus friendly country. But I actually know the person who did the lights. He's a professor of lighting design. So this isn't just your normal disco lighting. This is informed by critical theory and high aesthetics.
Wow. So far...
You know, which is what you can get if you are sort of the official gay club of the country. You get all this pro bono stuff from professionals who are happy to donate their services to have this place look, you know, as nice as any club that you could find in any country anywhere.
Now, do they support their neighboring Scandinavian countries by serving Absolut from the country of Sweden, or is that kind of taboo there?
No, it's not. You know,
that's a country that's owned by the country of Sweden. Absolut is a national brand. It's not a privately owned liquor company, which is kind of bizarre in my mind, but.
Yeah. And it's also something they positioned as for export markets. I could ask. The thing is, Finland has its own kind of rye vodka called Koskenkorva, and that is more popular than Finlandia, which was created for export. So I don't actually know that I ever saw someone drinking Finlandia or Absolut. My Finland's bilingual. They have a lot of Swedish speakers, especially in the Helsinki area. So I can imagine that if you were a Swedish speaker, to have the Swedish vodka might be an attractive option. But Finns are also, they have a complicated relationship with Sweden. And so I only ever saw people drinking Koskenkorva, including the standard shot that you have there is a salt licorice shot that Koskenkorva makes that's, an acquired taste. I like it, but it really is something else. And that I had for the first time at DTM.
So far, you are batting 1,000 with the gay bars that we've talked about. Every one of them has had a significant impact on their own marketplace, has made some impression on you, and has lasted a good while in their particular area. So again, you must have that good luck charm, in there, kind of keeping these things going. One last question I wanted to ask you about your bar experiences is, if there was one gay bar that you know about from the past that you could bring back to life and revisit, what would that bar be and why?
So the bar I would pick is called the Garden of Allah. And I'm only going to pick it because I recently read a social history of this bar. And I'm sure that it's only special because this community historian found this treasure trove of photographs from this bar and was able to do oral histories with a bunch of people who had gone to this bar. The Garden of Allah was in Seattle, Washington. It was in Pioneer Square, which is both the oldest neighborhood of Seattle and was adjacent to their Skid Row. So until very recently, it was kind of dumpy. And I guess it was really a going concern back in the 30s when this bar opened in the late 30s, early 40s. It became a queer place from the beginning. The author of the book, An Evening at the Garden of Allah, the author claims that this was the first gay-owned gay bar in Seattle. And I have no reason to doubt it. But he makes this point that by having gay ownership, certain aesthetics and certain performance was permitted there that wasn't at other places. What I find interesting about this bar, it's probably pretty similar to the White Horse in Oakland's early days. It's hard when you say something is a gay bar in the 30s because our version of what gay is not the same as it was back in the 30s. And most of these places weren't exclusively gay. They were bohemian. And so there were LGBTQ plus people and artists and soldiers and sailors and single people and slummers, middle-class white folks from the suburbs coming in to look at the freaks, and people who felt themselves were freakies were all sort of mixed together. And that sounds to be the case here at the Garden of Allah. But it was also a show bar. So they had live music. They had drag kings, even in the early 40s. They had drag queens. It sounds like some of these drag queens were gay men who dressed up as women. And some of them, it sounds like they were trans women who were doing shows. One of the things I found interesting about the book is that the bar sounds pretty similar to some bars today, insofar as drag has really been having a resurgence over the last decade. But also bars have increasingly had to turn to live entertainment. I'm writing this book project or finishing this book on gay bars, where I interviewed gay bar owners. And owners who've been in the business for a long time said, like, you know, in the old days, 25 years ago, we just opened the door and the gay people came in. And now you have to have trivia night, or you have to have karaoke, or you've got to have drag. You have to offer people some sort of entertainment to bring them in. And so there's been this resurgence of drag of all forms, sort of an efflorescence. But there's also been an incorporation of burlesque. And the Garden of Allah also had burlesque shows. So they were having live jazz, as was the case in most places back in those days. Drag performance meant live singing, not lip syncing. Lip syncing came in later, in the 50s. So at the beginning, this bar was, you know, these were artists. In fact, drag used to be a put down from the artists. It was the female impersonators who were able to sing as women, and that was part of the skill set that was desired. This bar was down near the Navy port, so apparently it was full of sailors. Apparently there was plenty of pickups between queer men and straight men. Apparently it had a very lively lesbian scene. There was drag kings who were sort of beloved by the lesbians who would come to see them. But also there was a lot of fandom between lesbians and the trans women and the gay men who were doing drag up on the stage. So in reading this book recently, I was struck by how modern in some ways it seemed. That the kind of performances and the kind of the fact that it was an LGBTQ plus place and not just a gay man's bar or a lesbian bar. And the fact that there was this big mix between straight people and queer people, which is increasingly the case at our bars today. So in those ways, it seemed very contemporary, which is surprising for a bar from the 40s. And then of course, you know, the idea that you could cruise sailors and, you know, the sort of romance of people wearing spats, and back when people had to wear hats and jackets, that, you know, that has its appeal to me too. So that's the bar I pick.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. Do you know if the building is still there, or has the building been destroyed?
The building, I believe, is not there. I think I checked, and I think it's condos. And I think the building is gone, but I would have to double check that.
Did you notice in the course of reading the book or any other information you have acquired since then, whether or not the bar was generally accepted without, I'm going to say without prejudice, but, you know, in the later years, in the 50s, 60s, you hear more about bars that have protesters or random hoodlums throwing eggs at patrons or harassing people in line. But I get the impression from what you've said that this was just accepted as kind of a cool place to go for entertainment. And everybody went there, very bohemian, cosmopolitan, whatever, no real tension. Was that the case, or do you know?
So apparently, because it was gay owned, the owners prevented there from being like same-sex dancing. There was a dance floor, but men were not allowed to dance together because that wasn't permitted by state law, so, or at least the liquor agency. So it wasn't as wild and crazy as this other club that was around the corner. That place did permit men to dance together, and it would get busted over and over again. I think it was called the Casino. Women could dance together because, of course, we all know that if women dance together, that's just fine. But men is, you know, it's crazy and slutty.
Of course, that makes sense.
The owners were paying off the police. So in San Francisco, in Seattle, there wasn't a mafia crime syndicate element to gay bar ownership the way that there was in New York. Like San Francisco, it was the police doing the crime syndication, keeping it all in-house. So the owners were paying off the police. That allowed them to have outrageousness. They were cited for having, for some of the performers being too obscene. So it's not like there wasn't friction. And I'm sure that, you know, backstage, I'm sure people were being told, like, stop telling that joke, you know, quit, you know, could you, you know, no more single entendres. Can you make it a double, please? Just so that we can pretend like this isn't a totally obscene show. So I'm sure that there was tension there because, you know, because of the times. And it was an edgy place. It was edgy for queer people to go there to be seen going to that place. And it was edgy for straight people to go and see female impersonators. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like going to an Applebee's.
Right.
It was an edgy place in the edgy part of town, near the strip clubs, near the gambling dens. So it was in, you know, sort of their vice district. But, you know, there it was. And I guess it lasted for a good 12 years or so, more than a decade in any case.
Sounds pretty iconic. And I'm definitely glad you brought that to our attention, because there's so many bars out there that the stories will just get lost. You know, we're getting to a point now where there's a large group of people who are very active in the bar scene, even 40 or 50 years ago, that are no longer going to be with us pretty shortly. And anything before that, most of those people are gone. Anything from the, you know, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, most of the people that patronize those bars are not around to tell their stories, and there's no internet to preserve it back then. So by us being able to dig up some of these facts and talk about some of these bars, I think is an important part of recording our gay history. One of the taglines that I use for my project is exploring gay history one bar at a time. Now, speaking of gay bar history, you're currently working on a project which apparently has been underway, I'm going to guess, for 5 years, maybe longer, called Who Needs Gay Bars? And that question was addressed recently. Have you had the opportunity yet to see the movie Swan Song?
No.
So I strongly recommend you see it. It's a great movie by Todd Stevens, who was known for doing Edge of 17 back 20 odd years ago, and who is also responsible for another gay movie and some of those films. But Swan Song is the third story in a trilogy about Sandusky, Ohio.
Yeah.
And in Swan Song, there's an elderly character who is played by Udo Kier, the marvelous character actor that's appeared in hundreds of movies. Udo plays an aged gay man who used to be kind of the celebrity hairdresser slash drag queen in this little town of Sandusky. And he's in a retirement home, and he breaks out of the retirement home and walks a couple of miles to downtown Sandusky to go revisit the gayborhood. And he happens to stumble into the bar where he used to perform, which is called the Universal Fruit and Nut Company. And in that bar, the bartender is a young guy standing there playing on his phone, ignoring the customers. And he informs Udo that this is the last night of the bar, that they're closing after 41 years. And there's a classic line in there to me that Udo says, in a broken German accent, he says, "When all the bars close, where will we dance?" And to me, that's just, you know, that's a question that I've wondered. It's great to be able to go to Applebee's with your husband or whatever and have dinner and not be stared at because there's two or four guys sitting at one table together eating. But it's a completely different thing to be able to express yourself a little more flamboyantly and be on the dance floor and do all the things that you want to do. And I think your study probably will address this. Who needs gay bars? So what inspired that, and what is the concept behind the book?
So the concept is Americans are pretty ambivalent about gay bars and LGBTQ plus people. We have ourselves been quite ambivalent about gay bars back through the 20th century. middle class white gay folks finding them not as respectable. And so, you know, Daughters of Bilitis was founded specifically as an alternative to lesbian bars by middle class white women who wanted to organize their lesbianism differently away from the butch femme scene of the bars. But then there's been this celebration of gay bars as being, you know, the origin of the gay rights movement, being a raid on the Stonewall Inn, projects such as yours that find that a lot of our local history is embedded in these bars, both in our memories of them and how they affected us, but also for the people they bring together. So the question of the title is supposed to capture that ambivalence, like these days, who needs them? But also who really does need gay bars? People who have just come out of the closet, or people who are recently widowed, or gay bars haven't always been that friendly to people of color or to trans and gender nonconforming people. So are gay bars still needed for those folks, maybe more than the middle-class white men who have always been sort of ambivalent about gay bars? So that's the concept. The project started because my favorite gay bar in Cleveland, Ohio, which is about 45 minutes here from me in small town Ohio, Sandusky is just up the road. It's actually closer for me to get to Sandusky than it is to get to Cleveland. My favorite gay bar closed, and at the time I was convinced that it was gentrification that had pushed it out. And I wrote this very... I wrote a rant, and it was published in a local magazine, and the owner of the building threatened to sue me, was really unhappy with it. But it started me on this project, like, what happened to that bar? Are gay bars going away? Is what's happening in Cleveland the same as what's happening on the coasts? You know, I jumped to this conclusion about gentrification, even though I should have known better. Because, you know, problems that Rust Belt cities have is very different from what's going on the coasts. And so it started this project. So part of it was with undergraduate research assistants, I got my hands on the Damron guides from all the years that end in 2 and 7. So 1972 and 77 and 82 and 87. And we just went and counted all the gay bars listed by municipality and made a data set. And that allowed me to conclude that gay bars are, at least gay bar listings are on the decline. And about 36% of gay bar listings disappeared between 2007 and 2019. So a little more than a third in... a little more than a decade. And the other part, I started interviewing gay bar owners and managers because I thought, first of all, nobody to my knowledge has interviewed owners as a category. And they have sort of a unique insights into what's been going on in the bar business since they are business owners and have been responding to recent trends of, you know, the rise of virtual socializing, including on apps like Grindr and Scruff and Tinder, and the rise of LGBTQ plus equality, where we see, I would say, a renewed ambivalence about gay bars. I hear especially white middle-class gay men saying, you know, who needs them? And, you know, every bar I go to is a gay bar, or like, who needs a gay bar? We can just go anywhere we like. And, you know, I think that's nice if you're cis and, you know, aren't too flamboyant and, you know, don't want to grab your partner's ass in public, then, you know, sure, go to Applebee's. But for others of us, I think there is still a need, and bars have had to change in order to embrace broader parts of the LGBTQ plus community. And so I went on 3 major road trips. I've interviewed more than 100 gay bar owners and managers in 35 states and the District of Columbia. And, you know, that's what I'm writing up is, you know, what I learned by talking with those people.
Now, is this book going to be something that, you know, your average intellectual person, I mean, someone who actually reads books, is going to want to pick up and read to learn about the topic? I mean, if they're interested in the topic in general, of course, are they going to want to read it? Or is it more of an academic work that you'd have to be like a sociologist or, you know, an English major to comprehend the nuances of how you're going to present it? Is it made for the mainstream or not?
It's made for the mainstream. It's with a trade imprint. So it's meant for a broad audience. I have been soundly critiqued by some of my sociologist colleagues that the book isn't academic enough. And that's fine. I wrote my academic book. Nobody read it. I know there's a lot of interest in gay bars. I'm writing this for us, by us. And the conceit of the book is that it's, that I learned 36 things, and each thing is organized around one bar around the country. So it's both a loving, critical profile of 36 gay bars and what I learned from that bar that was carried out over the other bars that I went to. So it's supposed to feel like bar hopping. And unlike bar hopping, where you have to go to a gay neighborhood and you can only go to the 8 or 9 there, this you bar hop from Milwaukee to Dallas to Panama City, Florida to Los Angeles to Seattle.
It sounds like I'm going to be in love with this book because you're also preserving the memories of those bars in there, which is the whole focal point of my project, is preserving the fact that they did exist and they did have some impact on their local market and on our gay community as a whole. So I think I'm looking forward to it. I've been looking forward to it. I've seen, you know, your posts on social media, and, you know, I've read some of your blog on your website and things of that nature. And to me, it's really a fascinating subject area. In fact, the whole reason my project got started is because I was talking to the owner of a gay bar from Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta for about 20 years, and I spoke to the owner of my favorite gay bar in Atlanta, which was Backstreet. And Backstreet was iconic in Atlanta. I mean, back in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, if you mentioned Atlanta gay bars and didn't say Backstreet, people thought you were just crazy. At the end of its existence, it was a 24-hour nightclub. It was by law, because they had a 24-hour liquor license, they could never close the door. They had to serve liquor around the clock every single day of the year. And they had closed in about 2004 due to gentrification. It's now a gigantic high-rise in that spot. But I was talking to the owner, and it was the end of 2019. And she said, you know, it'd be nice if we did a design to commemorate the 45th year since the day we opened in Atlanta. They opened in 75. And so I worked on it with her logo and her blessings. And we came out with a design that we made as a fundraiser for the local Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And we put it out there on the market, and it sold like wildfire. And I got to thinking about all the other bars from those years that I used to go to in Atlanta. And one by one, I started digging up information online and tracking down the old owner or an old picture, photograph, whatever. And in a few months, I had about half a dozen of them. And I thought, you know, this is kind of cool. It's a walk down memory lane. Every time I would post something on social media, people would respond and go, oh, my God, I'd love that bartender. The DJ there was great. I remember when he played so-and-so. And it really started a community response. And I thought, you know, this is cool. So then COVID hit and shut down all of our socializing, and pretty much going anywhere other than to work. And, you know, that was it. You didn't even go out to dinner anymore. And I really dove into the project. And since then, I have tracked down and documented about 1,500 gay bars across the country that no longer exist.
That's amazing.
But it all started because of the love of one gay bar that had a huge impact on me as a young gay man and, you know, the evolution of my personality and everything else. And so it's a really exciting feel to me, especially because, as you know, the history, gay history, if you look for it online, so much of it is about, you know, reactionary people, activists, organizations, political suppression. It's all about the laws and the societal feelings about the gay community and being discriminated and all this. And so little of it is about the bars, which is really, especially going back to those times, those were our churches. They were our community centers. They were our homes. You know, that's where we went to feel like we were a real person and to express, you know, our authentic self. And I think it would be really sad to lose those memories. So I'm really glad that you're doing this also and, you know, taking it from a different perspective.
Yeah. I mean, some of it, the perspective comes by virtue of me being a sociologist that, you know, I'm hyper conscious of the fact that for many of us, they were homes and churches. And then, you know, the bars, many of gay bars were kind of misogynistic, or not even kind of. And, you know, plenty of gay bars were pretty racist too. So, you know, I've been interested to learn from owners, how have they changed their conception of who we are? Who is the we and who needs gay bars, or who is the we in the LGBTQ plus community? As bars have had to reach out more deeply into the community to keep themselves afloat, but also how lots of gay bars have incorporated a lot of straight folks, and it doesn't seem to have engaged them as much as you might think. So, you know, there's lots of interesting things going on. I think for younger folks, you know, I am surrounded by 19 and 20 year olds by virtue of teaching at a college, and they are, you know, for them, sexuality is not such a big deal. They're more interested in gender. And so I think gay bars are going to have to change in order to, as gay bars have always changed, as each older generation feels like the younger generation doesn't understand what they went through. And I am now old enough to experience that in the classroom. And I think we will experience it in our places. But there is always going to be places that are identified as queer. And it's just the nature of those places is going to change. And it's one of the things I found so interesting about that book about the Garden of Allah is there you had a place that was wildly, outrageously queer and was integrated with straight folks. And that seems to be where things are headed.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing your book when it comes out. We're looking at what, about another year before we actually see it on the.
Yeah. Oops. I am rapidly, I have to turn in the manuscript on November 1st. So
I will definitely look forward to that. And I'll put a link to your blog and your website at the end of the video, so everybody can kind of keep tabs on you and look for the book information as it comes along. And of course, read your blog so they
can get
some insight. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about some of your gay bar memories and about your book project. And I look forward to reading that book when it comes out. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And thank you so much for doing this project. This is really great.
And that concludes another segment of the Gay Bar Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gaybarchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.